Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
You see Albert on the ground with his big camera, and he's on his back, and he's shooting upwards towards Amelia, and she's like, you know, kind of towering, you know, up there by her, on over him, like on this plane. It's how the world saw Amelia. She, you know, was this heroine, and she was this sign of hope in the Great Depression.
Nicole Swinford is an author, writer, historian, videographer, and broadcaster. She is a history teller. Nicole's first book, Amelia Earhart's Last Photo Shoot, was published by the Paragon Agency in May of 2015. Based on a never-before-seen film of Amelia's last photo shoot as she prepares to leave on her fatal world flight, the book and film were featured on outlets such as Fox News Business and National Geographic, amongst others. This was followed up with Amelia Earhart's last flight to Hawaii in May 2016. Nicole's work also appears in the Digby Stewart War Memorial, in which she writes the section, Women on the Digby Stewart Memorial. The book will be released in 2018 in honor of the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War. On episode 31 of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Nicole sits down with us via Zoom from London to discuss Amelia Earhart, her last photo shoot, the world flight, and the reasons that Amelia Earhart may have been tied closer to the United States government than anyone else ever thought possible. Nicole, thank you so much for coming aboard the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I'm going to start the interview the same way I start every interview I do. Can you talk a little bit about your education and your background and what made you want to become a writer?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a writer and historian with a bit of a background in media. I have my BFA from Chapman University in Orange, California in broadcast journalism and television with a minor in history. And I'm in London right now, where I came when I got my master's in historical research. So yeah, writing and history, history is the grandest story ever to be told, right? So it really, for me, it just started at a very young age. I was always a total bookworm, wanted to write constantly, tell stories. And I was incredibly blessed to have all four of my grandparents living around me, around our family. And I just would sit for hours and listen to all of their stories from growing up back in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, you know, and hear my parents' stories going through the 50s, 60s, you know, etc. So the past to me was always something that was very close to the present and living and breathing. And I thought that's the story that's worth telling and investigating.
Yeah, and you touched a little bit about history. What is it, just in your opinion, that makes history so fascinating? And I've talked to several people that just say, you know, history and mystery just kind of, they're just a natural fit for each other because there's so much we don't know and so much that's really unexplored and so many different possibilities. What is it about that just kind of attracted you to that and just in general?
Yeah, it's really just this passion for the truth and trying to dig and see how close to the truth you can get. And that's a particular challenge in history and going back through history to really capture that. I once read that there were three histories, that there's what's really happened, what people think happened, and what other people want you to think happened. And you have to dig through all of those clues to try to get as close as you can to the actual truth. That's the goal, you know.
So there's obviously a lot of people you can choose to write about. Can you tell me a little bit about how Amelia Earhart came into your life and why you chose her to do your books on?
Yeah. Amelia Earhart, she's been a constant ever since I was a little girl. I think she's one of the handful of women, historical women, that every little girl learns about, really. From an early age, she's such an inspiring figure. For us to really, all the possibilities in the world and a go-getter. She's a great, great role model for young girls. And so she was has been a part of my life from a very early age. And that mystery, you know, it sticks with you because it's as inspiring as she is, it's such a tragic ending, you know, to not know where she is and what happened. I think that definitely drives us. Specifically, I started writing on Amelia. The first book actually came about because I knew Doug Westfall, and he had this, he got a hold of this video, never before seen video. And because of my background with television and media, he called me up and he said, "Oh, you're gonna love this. You'll appreciate this one." And so I went on over and watched it, and I was just floored. I was so excited about it. And so that really jump-started the whole, you know, let's write books. Let's, you know, start with this video and investigate there and go from there.
Yeah. That's a great segue into some of the questions we're going to talk about today. So what I'd like to do is there's so much data out there, and there's so much information in the books you've written, but I want to highlight some of the excerpts from the book, Amelia Earhart's Last Photo Shoot. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay. So I want to talk about an event that's early on in her career with her first flight instructor, Netta Snook. And Doug has actually mentioned this event to me in passing before too. And I think it's really fascinating. So one day, Amelia and Netta they're taking off from Goodyear Field, about 6 miles from Kenner Field. And that's where they were headed. Upon takeoff, their plane didn't gain enough altitude fast enough to clear the tree line, and they either have to nosedive into the field or nosedive into the trees. Amelia has to make a quick decision. So she does, and she pulls up and she nosedives. And it's a big moment for her because it's the first time that really something goes wrong for her. She's had a lot of success up to this point, and she's kind of been a natural, but this incident happens. And the first thing she does when she gets on the ground and she kind of gets herself back together is she starts putting makeup on. And she tells Netta that, you know, we have to look nice when the reporters come. Can you talk a little bit about how that was for her? I mean, she had a wonderful way about being able to just flip a switch. It was almost Marilyn Monroe-like in my eyes. You know, she could just turn something on. Do you think it was easy for her to balance that tomboy persona that she grew up with and that she was kind of a natural at with this kind of all-American girl persona for the media?
Yes, in a way, I think she could flip that switch pretty easily because the way I see her, the interesting thing about her is that they're not two completely separate personas. I think the tomboy persona and the girl next door persona had a very unique combination in her. And so it was all about which one she was going to emphasize at that particular moment. But she definitely was a mini layered woman. And so I think that both of those personas are interwoven in her in a very authentic way. And that's really, I think, what endeared her to the public, that unique persona that could relate to a variety of different people and in different situations. Yeah.
Yeah. In talking about some of the first impressions of Amelia, John Montijo, who was another early instructor of her, he quoted, and I'm going to read from your book as well. He said, "Amelia was one of three girls who brought their planes to me in 1922 at Kenner Airport. Each girl had purchased an airplane and wanted instructions. Amelia was an excellent student and was very thorough on what she undertook. Her first solo was the perfect takeoff, and after 10 minutes, she made a landing worthy of a veteran. She never exhibited any bit of nervousness, even when she went solo after her seventh lesson." We often hear that Miss Earhart didn't exude fear whatsoever. She was fearless. And my talks with kids regarding her, I often talk about how important it is to overcome those fears, because everything you ever wanted is just on the other side of fear. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that Amelia understood more than most everyone. Can you talk a little bit about the role that fear plays just in general in our lives, and kind of how we can overcome that, how important that is to overcome fear, mm-hmm. just in general, so we can achieve our goals and achieve what we want?
Yeah, fear is, oh my goodness, it's so important. It's so important to stress this, like you said, when you're talking to kids, because we all have it. It's an innate part of the human experience, you know, that we have different fears. But fears, not only do they inhibit, you know, success, but it's fear is the enemy to all that is really good in life. I think the important thing to remember is that feeling fear and being afraid and acting on it are two very different things. I'm sure Amelia felt the fear of being a human being, but what's so inspiring is that she chose not to make choices out of fear, chose not to act afraid. And that's really where courage comes in. And that's the choice that I think we all have to make every day and say that, you know, my fears are not going to dictate my life. That's how we overcome it. And we wake up every day and make that choice just continually. I think that's so important. Yeah.
Do you think she was, and this is a question I ask a lot of people just because I think it's an important one. Do you think she was comfortable with the fame? I think that obviously she loved flying. It was in her soul. It was a passion that she had that obviously never left her for her entire life. But do you think she was comfortable with the fame? I kind of get the sense that she could kind of give or take the fame and just wanted to fly.
Yeah. She was all about the craft, all about, the craft, the sport, you know, that passion. I don't think she particularly enjoyed the fame. I think it was something that she could accept and that she could handle very gracefully. But yeah, I don't get the sense that she ever wanted the fame. It was just something that came along with the career she wanted, you know.
Yeah, in 1930, she sets a woman's record for flying speed, 181 miles an hour. She also becomes the first woman to pilot an autogyro, which was an experimental craft at the time, and she breaks two records with that, an altitude record and being the first person to fly it across the U.S. And this is mind-boggling. After only 15 minutes of instruction, she says, "I got it," and she takes it across the U.S. and breaks two records. And this all takes place before she makes a transatlantic flight and kind of just gets shot into the stratosphere of this worldwide fame. Do you think there was a method to which she chose to go about setting these records? Is this just kind of the way everything came to her and she just kind of started knocking these down one by one and then it just kind of, it became what it became?
Well, I mean, she clearly had goals, I think, you know, the determination and the work ethic that she had. She wasn't one to just sit around and waste an opportunity. I think she, I get the sense that she would have set out the list of these are the goals I'm going to go after, but the list was flexible. I think that if an opportunity came along, then she could, you know, gear off into that. But definitely with her dedication, she wouldn't say, "Hey, let's see what happens, which record I break first." I think she would have made the list and just started going at it. Yeah.
She was, I think that she just had this innate sense of just taking advantage of every opportunity that came her way and just going for it. Even if it was an experimental thing, like the autogyro in this case, she just, okay, I'll get in it, I'll fly it. And if you look at some of the photos that she has, they're suiting her up into this apparatus and this thing. I mean, it was would have scared a lot of people, I think, but she just, never, it seemed like it never occurred to her that fear was never even an option. It's just, I'll do it.
Yeah. She was definitely a go-getter and, you know, you won't know until you've tried. So, yeah, definitely. And she was very good at recognizing opportunity and really making the most of it. That's what she did with the friendship flight, really, after that, you know.
Yeah, she was great. It's just she continues to inspire. Do you think, Amelia became the first woman and first civilian to receive the Distinguished Flying Cross in 1932. There was a lot of controversy with that because she wasn't military. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, just your perceptions or your thoughts of what you think she must have been feeling during that whole thing? Did she just kind of have tunnel vision or how did that controversy surrounding that reception of that Distinguished Medal kind of affect her morale? Do you think that people started talking about, well, here's this woman who, you know, she didn't serve. She's only a woman, quote unquote, and she's getting these things. You know, how do you think that affected her?
You know, I think confronting any sort of controversy, naysayers, I think that's got to take its toll on anyone. And I don't think she's immune to that. At the same time, considering the Flying Cross, the award, it was a relatively new award. They only started it in 1926. And it was for people, the very first ones were awarded during peacetime for people who had achieved these great endurance flights and altitude records, etc. Lindenberg got the first one in 1927 for his crossing of the Atlantic and along some others also. So when you look at Amelia, I think Amelia comes along, and yes, she's a woman, and yes, she's a civilian, but I think considering her crossing of the Atlantic, and on top of that, she doesn't only cross, she sets a speed record while doing it. She definitely, I think, can hold her head up high and say, you know, I did earn this award, even if I am just a civilian. I am of the same caliber as these other pilots. So not pleasant, surely, but I think that she definitely had nothing to be ashamed of in the end. And I'm sure that she realized that, and that those who supported her were reminded her of that, I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, we obviously hear about the term and the nickname Lady Lindy from her. Everybody mm-hmm. referred to her as Lady Lindy. Do you think, I mean, just, and I know we're speculating here, but do you think that that is something that, do you think she endeared, that was like an endearing term to her? Or do you think that that was something that kind of was maybe nice at first, but kind of frustrating because she didn't want to be referred to as Lady Lindy. She wanted to be referred to as Amelia Earhart, someone different.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, I think the first time it may have been a compliment considering Lindenberg's status, but after that first time, you know, she's her own woman, her, you know, an individual and her own pilot, you know, and I think that definitely took its toll over the years when that name wouldn't go away. That would have been frustrating to set all these records and say, I did that in my own right, you know, so absolutely. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about a particular incident that you speak of in the book, Amelia Earhart's last, or Amelia's last photo shoot, regarding the aftermath of the ground loop incident in Hawaii. And it's, I'm going to quote from the book directly because it really kind of struck me when I read it. So they returned to California to await repairs on the plane, an undertaking that took nearly 1.5 months, 45 days to be exact. During this time, other drastic changes are made to the flight plan as well as funding. Don Fobel was there for the Electra's return and says simply this: after the wreck in Hawaii, the Electra was brought back to the factory and rebuilt by a special crew. We were not allowed to see it. What in the world could that have been about? And has there ever been any speculation or assumption as to whether or not Ms. Earhart knew about this special crew and what they were doing with her plane at that time?
Yeah, what is that about? That's such an enticing statement to make. It just heightens the history and the mystery of all of this. And I think because the situation that we have, and really I go into in this book, is that her disappearance isn't the only mystery. That's not, there's a much bigger mystery. Her entire flight is a bit mysterious, full of interesting tidbits like this, a lot of little mysteries, I call them, and this is definitely one of them, because no one's really certain why other people couldn't see the plane, why it was restricted to this special crew. Amelia never talks about it herself or gives much of an indication about it, but as the pilot, I do think that she would have been aware of everything that was being done to her plane. To undertake this flight was incredibly dangerous. And so as the pilot, she would have had to know any changes that would have been made to the plane. Otherwise her life was at risk. So I'm certain that she did know, but she never gives an indication as to what it was they were doing or why it was on the down low. Yeah.
And we'll take it a little bit further with this. Amelia and George had other worries on their plate at the time. And I'm quoting from your book. To now fund the second attempt after the ground loop incident in Hawaii. Repairs were estimated at $30,000, which was a lot of money at that time. The initial investment was lost, and with nothing of value left upon, they found themselves in a monetary catch-22. In order to bring in more money, Amelia needed to make her world flight, but in order to make the flight, she needed more money. So that's when the U.S. government seems to have stepped in, agreeing to fund the entire operation. A bold move for a country in the middle of the Great Depression. The U.S. government appears to have paid the bill, and it took 11 government agencies to coordinate this second attempt. Now, question. A coordinated effort by the U.S. government in the middle of a Great Depression to fund a trip for someone that was going to be flying into very interesting territory for the U.S. What's your take on this thing? Should it be looked at just at face value, or was there something much, much deeper going on here? Why in the world would they step in?
Yeah, you definitely sum up the situation very well there. And it's a very intriguing situation. And it could explain if the government was funding it, and they needed changes to the flight, that could explain some of the strange choices, certainly. We do know that on her flight, most likely as a thank you, she was collecting data for the Department of Agriculture, air samples and stuff. So we do know that they had her at least doing something on her flight. It wasn't completely scot-free. The question then becomes, were there other things that they needed, other, you know, information or whatnot, anything really, which we don't know for certain on that score, but there is enough mystery, I think, enough questions and speculations surrounding her flight, which a lot of very strange decisions, that I definitely think there's enough to continue an investigation on that score and keep that door open, definitely, because it's a very strange situation.
Yeah, how deep does it go? That's the question it goes. And is it just something that's agricultural based? Is it something that's much, much deeper, much more large? I guess that's something that's that ties into a lot of the different hypotheses out there, whether, you know, was Miss Earhart a spy? Was she a decoy possibly for another spy? You know, was this whole thing kind of planned out? I mean, you know, obviously different people are working those different hypotheses and working that out. But it's quite fascinating that, you know, 11 departments come in through the U.S. government to make this thing happen in the middle of the Depression. I think that's you know, a red flag and you know, in a lot of people's eyes. So it's important to look at that.
Absolutely.
So you talk a lot in your book about the decision to change the direction of the flight. That's obviously a well-known fact. Originally flying east to west, and then for some reason making the change and flying the opposite direction, west to east. Was it strictly weather? I know a lot of people just chalk that up to, well, the weather patterns at that time, it was later, and, you know, 3 and a half months later. Was there a larger reason for that, or do you think it was just strictly just weather and that's that?
No, I do think that there is, I don't know what the larger reason is, but I think that it exists for a few reasons, really. It is a very strange decision to reverse the flight, not only because this international coordination, it's not, you don't just reverse your, it took months to plan this, and you don't just reverse it on a whim. Let's say we're going to do this, and you have to renegotiate all sorts of different stops and where you're going to be and landing rights and overflying rights and redo the visas. Like, there's so much that goes into it on that level, but also because flying west to east, it's not something that a veteran pilot would do. A veteran pilot would know that that's a more dangerous route to take, that that's more physically draining on the pilot to fly against the sun, that she's losing light when she flies that way, which puts her on an even tighter schedule and makes it even more dangerous. There's, you know, it's so much easier to keep her original route. So the idea that she's going to reverse it certainly is interesting or concerning. And then the last thing that bothers me about that choice is her explanation of the weather seems rather flimsy to me. She says, you know, oh, weather over Africa. But her starting point for the flight is California, which makes Africa her halfway point. No matter which direction she's going in, she's going to get there at roughly the same time. Is there really that much of a difference to justify completely uprooting everything and taking a riskier route and all the rest of it? It just doesn't seem, it's not a satisfactory explanation in and of itself. So I do think that there was more to that decision that she simply wasn't talking about.
And we'll talk a little bit more about some other interesting decisions. One, again, that you talk about in your book in detail. There's a significant change in the plane once they arrive in Miami. Her trailing antenna and her 500 KCS crystals removed from the plane. Something in the book strikes me as odd, and it's what she loses with having it removed. Initially, she has a 2,000-mile radius in communication on the original trailing antenna. However, when that's removed, she drops a zero, and now it's a 200-mile radius for communication in the middle of the ocean. On top of that, with the removal of her 500 KCS crystal, which is approximately 3 ounces of weight, she now loses the ability to transmit to the outlying support ships that have been set up on her flight. And this is something that's been going on for quite some time. Why do you think she felt that she had to have those removed? Was that something that was an Amelia Earhart decision? Was that maybe someone else's decision? I mean, did she just think like, you know what, we don't need it? I mean, it's 3 ounces for the KCS mm-hmm. crystal. I know they were trying to get as much weight off the plane as physically possible, but 3 ounces is kind of strange.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's strange, not only because she, you know, took out these things, but she had top of the line, the latest radio equipment, and then she downgrades to old radio equipment. It's just kind of, you know, it's another little mystery, another strange decision. She was having radio problems all the way up to the point where she started the flight, and even during the world flight, she was continuing to have radio problems. They seem to never have really gone away. On the one hand, you wonder, because she herself was not the most tech-savvy person. She was a very instinctive flyer. She knew what she had to do, but she didn't know all of the ins and outs of the whole tech thing. So on one hand, you'd say maybe she really didn't think that it would be that significant of a difference in the big picture. But then on the other hand, you have to wonder, what were her radio experts telling her? The men who are working on these radios, who are trying to fix them, you know, did surely she would take into account their advice? And I know that a few of them were nervous about the changes. I think it's also worth noting that she adds something. She doesn't just take away all that. She adds a military frequency to her radios, which is interesting that she would decide to take out the frequency that gives her access to her support ships, but then she's going to replace it with military frequency. There's never an explanation for that. No one ever really talks about it. We know it was there, though, specifically because in her last communications, requests that she's trying to get them on during the very end there, when she's trying to make contact and come into Howland. It's kind of, it's one of those where if you want to smile and say, oh, it's one of those things and benefit of the doubt, so to speak, then you'd say, well, she's not, she wasn't an overly technical person. She never had to be before, and she might not have realized the full significance. But I think, given the context of the flight, of all of these little strange decisions and all that really coming together, you have to take it seriously and say that there must have been another reason for it. It must have played into the larger picture in some way, because it's a dramatic change. And the sad reality is that had she kept the original radio equipment, we might not even be having this conversation today. And that's heartbreaking, really. Yeah.
So let's recap. She changes her frequency from her support ship frequency that was agreed upon to a military frequency all of a sudden. She removes her KCS crystal. She removes her trailing antenna, and she reverses her route in the opposite way, all in the span of a very short amount of time, right before the U.S. government decides to step in and fund this flight. I think an argument can be made that, you know, something larger that, you can take things on face value, maybe one thing, maybe two things, but if there's a list of things that are happening, and it's just, if all that's in coincidence, it's just an interesting I guess it's an interesting turn of events right before this monotonous and very long flight. And of course you throw in where she's going and what she's going to be flying over. And I think it's a case that can be made that, you know, something maybe larger could have been going on.
Yeah, I definitely think so. It's like you said, you can take one or two things and say, well, maybe that's just life. Life happens. But I think there's enough here that just has piled up that you have to take it seriously. You have to question the narrative, you know, absolutely.
So let's shift a bit tonally. Can we talk a little bit about Amelia's impact and resonance on women 80 years later? Even then, of course, but now 80 years later. What's your personal take on her impact on generations of young girls? I can't tell you how much cosplay I see with Amelia Earhart. These young girls that are just dressing up as her. It's even more prominent than ever 80 years later. Can we talk a little bit about that impact that she continues to have after all this time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh my goodness, even when I was a kid, we were dressing up as Amelia Earhart. You know, she's timeless almost, definitely. As I said before, she's maybe one of a handful of women, historical women, that you learn about at a very young age, and for good reason. You know, her story is so inspiring, and she's so unique, and I think she's particularly needed in today's kind of culture and society because of her differences, not only because of her determination, her work ethic, her, you know, fearlessness in going after her dreams and her goals, all very good things and always, but I love her image, that unique image she had of, you know, that combination we talk about of being a woman, but still having that tomboyish quality. She definitely, I think, demonstrates to young girls how to very gracefully be a woman in a man's world, a man's profession, but still say, hey, I may be in this man's world, but I am still a woman, you know, and I'm not going to sacrifice that either. She's definitely a unique combination there as well. So, I mean, I think she's really the full package for young girls, which is why she's lasted so long in our hearts and our memories, and continues to inspire girls today, really. Yeah,
it goes all the way back to the very first thing we talked about was that incident where she, you know, wanted to apply makeup. She wanted to look, you know, presentable. She wanted to look pretty for the reporters and everything. I think she was just a master at walking that fine line. She could, you know, as my dad used to say, she could cuss like a Marine Corps DI. She could hang with the boys, but she was very, you know, she had very feminine qualities about her. She loved kids. She was great with kids. You know, so she just had this way of about her. And I think she inspires kids now, especially young girls, that, hey, you know, you can have, do, or be anything you want. There are no roadblocks. There are no, you know, even though there's fear, you know, you can push beyond that fear and you could achieve great things. And I think she was just a shining example of that aspect.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if she was alive today, what do you think she would think of just, you know, speaking about her impact, what do you think she would think of everybody that's out there working these individual hypotheses and trying to bring her back, and you know, this Amelia Earhart community that's very prominent and that's worldwide. Everybody's so fascinated with that, you know, that disappearance and kind of what happened and wanting to know what happened. What do you think she would think of all this just as a whole?
I think that she'd definitely be flattered and grateful that so many people still remember her and are, you know, thinking of her, worried about her, trying to figure out what happened to her. I definitely think she would appreciate that. I think in some ways she had such a great kind of quirky tone to her personality that I think she might have even gotten a kick out of some of it. Some of the, I always wonder what she thinks when we spin a new theory, if she's like, no, that's not right, or, oh, that's getting closer. I think she must be amused maybe with some of it. At the same time, I would imagine that if she were watching all of this, it would, after so many decades, start to become a little frustrating or tiresome to not be able to have your say or to explain what you did and why you did it and, you know, the circumstances and what happened. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, everyone, that is everyone's first question, right? When they hear that you do, that you write about Amelia or you do work, you know, with Amelia, they, their first question is, do you think we'll ever find her? Will we ever find out what happened? Everyone is dying to know what happened. And I think that it's definitely possible, you know, that we, that the answers are out there. If we, and it's really up to us if we're going to take the job seriously and really kind of take a look at everything that that's out there and what we know and what we don't know and what we need to, you know, find out to really put the pieces of the puzzle together as a whole. And that's why I'm so excited about your project, really. You know, I look at the whole situation and I think, oh, these are, you know, the two things I would do, you know, right now, you know, if we're going to get anywhere any closer to Amelia. And the first thing was gathering everything that we already have and putting it into one place and making sense of it all. And that's really what you're doing. You're so brilliant, the project that you're doing. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. Yeah, we're trying. It's been very interesting and we have a lot of people that are very excited about it. So. You have another book, speaking of projects, you have another book that's coming out with, you're working with Doug again in the Paragon Agency. Can you talk a little bit about that book? When can we expect it? What the release date is at potentially?
Yes. So that's going to be the third book, on Amelia. It's The Last Flight of Amelia. And basically we're traveling with her around the globe throughout her last flight. Really a lot of it is her own words, and then I'm there to kind of guide along and give historical context in the background and point out the some of the discrepancies, some of the questions that that this creates and all that. But it's really exciting to basically travel the last flight with her based on what she was able to write before she ultimately disappeared. The release date is sometime this year.
And where can folks and our listeners follow your work online and kind of reach out to you online if they want to just find out more about you and what you're doing?
Oh yeah. Well, you can find my author's Facebook page. It's just Nicole Swinford, and I call it my own little messy corner of the internet. It's technically my website. It's NicoleSwinford.com, and I basically just throw things up there, and there's a contact page there, and you can keep track of my books. When this next one gets published, I'll have the link for buying it on there, and looking if anyone's interested in looking into that. So yeah, those are probably the two places to check out.
any last words? Anything you want to convey, or anything we forgot to talk about, or anything you want to put out there regarding Amelia or your book, or anything like that?
No, I think we've really covered it. For me, what I've been looking at with Amelia, as we've said, really is the mystery of her flight as a whole. I think sometimes we can get tunnel vision on that last moment, and get so focused on trying to understand that disappearance that we forget about about the wider context and everything leading up to that moment. And I think that there are still so many questions about the flight as a whole that need answering, you know, that we won't really understand the disappearance fully until we can make progress in understanding the flight and all of the questions and mysteries that are surrounding the entire endeavor. So I don't have a most people, I think, have a specific theory as to what happened to her. I don't have a specific theory. I just know what holes I think need to be filled in next. And I'm all about the big picture. That's what I would say. I don't think we should get tunnel vision. I think that if we understand the flight, then we'll understand the disappearance.
I agree. It's not about how she died. It's about how she lived. And that's mm-hmm. most important. Well, thank you so much, Nicole. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Chasing Earhart podcast. And will you come back on when the book releases so we can talk further on that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It'd be my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow the project online at chasingearhart.com, as well as on social media with the hashtag @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't yet, please head to iTunes and rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Join me next week for a very special conversation with the daughter of Muriel Earhart Morsi and the niece of Amelia Earhart, Amy Kleppner. Thanks for listening.